Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Dr. Suzanne Stock, board-certified specialist in orthodontics. Dr. Stock is pleased to provide braces and Invisalign for children, teens, and adults in Iowa City and across Southeast Iowa. More online at drssortho.com.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. In Hollywood movies, on U.S. television, and even in the publishing industry, people of color, lesbian, gay, bisexual, or transgender characters, if they appear at all, are often relegated to the role of sidekick, stereotype, or villain. That's one of the reasons that Marvel's Black Panther was and is such a big deal. A glitzy, high-budget superhero movie featuring an almost entirely black cast. And most of the characters are strong, brilliant, and heroic men and women.
Millions of years ago, a meteorite made of vibranium, the strongest substance in the universe, struck the continent of Africa, affecting the plant life around it. And when the time of men came, five tribes settled on it and called it Wakanda.
This hour, we're going to talk about representation in popular culture, in the media. We'll talk about the impact it has on our culture and on individuals. And we really want to hear your stories this hour. When did you first see your identity, whatever it is, reflected in a positive way in popular culture? When did you first see yourself on the big screen, on television, or find yourself in the pages of a book that you loved? You can call us at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at Iowa Public Radio. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And with me right now is Noreen Nassim Rodriguez, Assistant Professor of Elementary Social Studies at Iowa State University School of Education. Hello, Noreen.
Hi.
Welcome back to the show.
Thanks.
And I want to start with your personal experiences. First, help us understand your cultural identity as you were growing up.
Okay. So I have to admit, first and foremost, that I'm new to Iowa. I'm almost at 1 year. And prior to that, I spent my whole life in Texas. I was born and raised in San Antonio, and I am the daughter of Asian immigrants. My mother is a Filipina immigrant who came in the 1970s to be a nurse, and my father immigrated from Pakistan to work on his master's. And they grew up in countries that were completely different from where I was growing up. The shared language of the home was English, and I was very much viewed by them as all American. But as I walked through the world and got older, it was very clear that my life experience, who I was, wasn't what I was seeing in everything else around me, whether it be the kids that I was in school with or the media that I consumed voraciously. Obviously, as a professor, I'm someone that really, really loves to read. And as a child, I remember just searching for something where I could see someone that looked like me. And if you go way back on my mother's side, we do have some Chinese ancestry. And so I remember seeing the books Tiki Tiki Tembo and the Five Chinese Brothers in school. And these are books that have long been part of the elementary canon. They're still used today. But these books are incredibly problematic and stereotypical. So in the Five Chinese Brothers, the characters all have slanted eyes, have bright yellow skin, and every single person is identical. And that was not a reflection of myself at all. And so it wasn't until I read The Babysitter's Club. And anyone who grew up in the 80s and 90s may recognize that title. There is an Asian American character named Claudia Kishi, who is Japanese American, and she loves art, and she wears these crazy clothes. And I also loved art, and I also kind of, you know, wanted to have some cool and individualistic style. And so even though I'm not Japanese American, that was the first time that I saw an Asian American character that wasn't a nerd, that wasn't a doctor. And so I started to see a little bit more of who I was starting to become in that character. But really, aside from the Babysitter's Club, I didn't encounter characters who were Asian American like me. And I certainly didn't encounter folks who were mixed Asian like I was. And that was something that kind of persisted throughout my education. While I was able to find East Asian American representation, there really wasn't any South Asian American representation growing up, except for the character of Apu from The Simpsons.
And Apu from The Simpsons is a character that a lot of people have been talking about recently, but also in the Indian American community, I'm sure talking about for many years. I think we have a little bit of a clip from Apu. And this is, of course, Apu is a fictional character on The Simpsons. He is the Indian immigrant proprietor of Quickie Mart, which is a popular convenience store in Springfield, the only convenience store in Springfield. And here's a clip of Apu applying for U.S. citizenship.
What was the cause of the Civil War?
Actually, there were numerous causes. Aside from the obvious schism between abolitionists and anti-abolitionists, economic factors, both domestic and international, played a significant...
Hey. Yeah. Just say slavery.
Slavery it is, sir.
Yes, I am a citizen. Now, which way to the welfare office?
What?
I'm kidding. I work.
So that's a clip of Apu from The Simpsons. It's, of course, a character voiced not by an Asian American or an Indian American or an Indian. I mean, so it's voiced by Hank Azaria. This character has been really problematic for a lot of Indian Americans for a very long time. How do you feel this affected you, Noreen?
So my experience with the character of Apu, I think, is pretty typical of a lot of the stories that have come up more recently after Hari Kondabolu's documentary, The Problem with Apu. Basically, all anyone understood that it meant to be an Indian American was to be Apu. And so people would find out that my father was from Pakistan, and immediately they would begin with the Apu accent, or they would assume that he worked in a gas station, not that he was highly educated and was an auditor working for Travelers Insurance. You know, these ideas that... Oh, this is the one example that I know because this is all I've ever seen. Therefore, this must apply to every member of this community. And that was really hurtful. And I think when that's the only representation, it's especially painful because you want to be recognized as an individual with all these unique qualities. And when people cling on to such a stereotypical character like that, it's problematic. And Hari actually says in the documentary, the character of Apu is basically a white man pretending to be a brown man making fun of my father. And that's, I think, a really accurate description of how many of us felt when we were attacked for our brown skin and attacked because our parents maybe held on to some of their South Asian culture when they came to America.
Well, and I can imagine, and Hari talks about this in the film, and we've interviewed him on Talk of Iowa about the documentary that he did. But it also, it gave a tool to anybody who wanted to bully Indian American, Pakistani American kids as they were growing up. I mean, it was like a gift to bullies everywhere.
Exactly. Yes, it truly was.
So let's talk about recently. There have been changes. There have been some really remarkable films, and we do see some changes in the publishing industry. Where have you seen yourself reflected recently?
I know that there were definitely some shifts as I got to college, but it's certainly become more and more obvious and noticeable to the point where I can share these experiences with other people. Mindy Kaling, who started off in The Office and then had her own show, The Mindy Project, is certainly one of those figures who I've been able to see in small roles, then develop her own show, and then to see her on the big screen in A Wrinkle in Time was incredible. Also in A Wrinkle in Time was a Filipino actor. I believe his name is Derek McCabe. He's the little brother in the movie. And never before have I been able to see a South Asian American and a Filipino American on screen in perfect American accents. Nothing about them is specific to the fact that they are Asian American. They're just characters that are dynamic and interesting. And their cultural and ethnic identity is not at the center. Just like when I walk through this world, I'm not always thinking about my own ethnicity. So I think that was the most recent example where I was like, yes, not quite the mixed identity that I have, but the closest I've ever seen.
And in seeing that, how do you think little Noreen would have responded to having that kind of opportunity?
I think it's just so important, especially as an educator, that we provide those mirrors to children to affirm them, to show them that you have different options in life, that for you to want to pursue art or music. And I'm getting emotional about this because I never saw that. And I took my daughter to see A Wrinkle in Time, and my daughter is she's mixed. I'm Pakistani and Filipina, Pakapina, as I affectionately like to refer to myself, and my husband is Mexican-American, and she was able to start to see people with different skin tones, with different hair types, who look more and more like her on the big screen, and that's so incredibly powerful, and I'm just so excited that she will have that, even if I didn't.
Right now, I know that children's literature is one of your areas of study, also one of your passions. How are we seeing things shift in children's literature? Because that's another area, I tell you, Noreen, when I was growing up, finding Heroic White Girls was not difficult for me. I saw myself in all the books that I loved. How do we see that shifting? Are we seeing better representation?
It's certainly improving. I think there are more options available than ever before, but it's still not representative. If we think about how the Latinx and Asian American populations have really increased tremendously since 1965, we're not seeing parity between what's available and who is in the United States. So that's one of the problems. But there is an increasing amount of books that don't just talk about people of color in the past, that also situate them doing everyday things in the modern day, which I think is super important that we see both of those examples. However, I think there's still a big problem, and it is that while any individual can order a book about Maggie G, one of the first two female Chinese pilots during World War II, they can get on Amazon or get online and order that real quick. It arrives in 2 days. We're not seeing those books in schools. We're not seeing a lot of those books in public libraries. And so even though as individuals we can start to find those books that maybe mirror our experiences or expose our children to a broader range of experiences and identities, it's not being implemented into the curriculum in powerful ways. So on a broader scale, that increase in diversity in children's literature isn't necessarily affecting everyone and reaching everyone in the ways that it could.
So it's available to the parents of means, to the people who seek it out, but it may not be something that a child who's looking at the library at school is going to stumble across.
Exactly. And part of that is Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie has a really famous TED Talk about the danger of a single story. And so there are some of these stories that are being included in Basel readers and that are found in classroom and school libraries. And maybe that's one story that's shared commonly. But if that's the only story, then the story is incomplete because you're not getting a full range of representations as you would with white children.
We are going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. We're talking about representation in media today. We're talking about representation in movies, on television, in books. And we want to hear your stories. When was the first time you saw your identity positively reflected in popular culture? Please give us a call, 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at Iowa Public Radio. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. With me, Noreen Nassim Rodriguez, assistant professor of elementary social studies at Iowa State University School of Education. And again, we'd love to hear from you. We'll be back in a moment. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Dr. Suzanne Stock, board-certified specialist in orthodontics. Dr. Stock is pleased to provide braces and Invisalign for children, teens, and adults in Iowa City and across Southeast Iowa. More online at drssortho.com.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about representation in media. People of color, lesbian, gay, bisexual, or transgender characters. These are people that are often relegated to the role of a sidekick or a stereotype or a villain or removed from the scene altogether. And this hour, we're talking about why representation in media, in movies, on television, in books, why it's important, how it affects our culture, how it affects individuals as well. And we'd love to hear your story this hour about when you first saw yourself reflected on the big screen, maybe, or in some kind of media in a positive way. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. You can tweet us at Iowa Public Radio. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Noreen Nassim Rodriguez is here with us, assistant professor of elementary social studies at Iowa State University School of Education. And Meenakshi Gigi Durham is also here, collegiate scholar and professor at the University of Iowa School of Journalism and Mass Communication. Hello, Gigi.
Hi, Charity.
Welcome back to the show.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
And I already put Noreen on the spot asking her about her personal experiences growing up. I want to hear yours as well. First of all, again, help us understand your cultural identity as you were growing up.
Yeah, it's interesting that she and I are both South Asian, actually. I was born in India, but my parents moved to the U.S. when I was very young and then to Canada, where I spent most of my childhood. At the time I was growing up, there were actually no representations of South Asians. It was pre-Apu. It was pre-everything. I mean, honestly, I never saw anyone like myself on television or in a movie or anything like that as a child.
And as a as a kid, did you think about that? I mean, now reflecting back, I'm sure you can see it in a different light. But was it something that you were looking for?
You know, I really do think I was. I kind of struggled with that for a long time because when I was a kid, the dominant discourse was one of assimilation, you know, kind of race blind, everybody's the same, you know, which wasn't true. I mean, according, you know, my own experience, my family, I mean, we were clearly different. And so, yeah, it was really hard to kind of find a place for myself. Yeah. So it did matter not to see anybody who looked like me.
Do you remember the first time you really felt like you saw a character or read a character that reflected your identity?
I mean, it's really interesting. I mean, I was kind of thinking back about this. And the only things that I can, I mean, what I really remember from my childhood is, and this is silly, but I think, but it sort of, I think it also speaks to something. Someone gave me a copy of the book Heidi when I was little. And, you know, Heidi, of course, is set in, you know, Germany or whatever it is, Switzerland.
In the Alps, yep.
Yeah. And yeah, I guess it was Switzerland, right? Yep. Heidi Swiss, yeah. Anyway, but the cover of the book had a picture of Heidi, who, and she actually was tanned and she had short, dark, curly hair, which was, you know, which is like, wow, that kid looks like me. I was like really thrilled with it. And so I loved that book just because the little girl on the cover looked so much like me, which is an interesting representation of a Swiss child, you know?
Yeah.
Because usually, you know, most of the copies of Heidi I've seen have blonde, blue-eyed girls on the cover, but that one didn't. And so that, and then I also remember a book, and this was all literature. I don't remember seeing anybody like myself on TV or in a movie or anything like that for years until we actually went to India when I was a teenager and I saw a Bollywood movie for the first time. But there was another book called Almina's Dogs, and it was about an African-American girl who loved dogs, and I love dogs, and, you know, the little girl on the cover did look like me. And so those were two things that, I mean, I really loved those books because, you know, they seem to speak to, you know, a kid like myself
in some way.
Yeah.
Well, you know, in the last year, the thing that actually made me think about having this conversation on the radio was a Facebook post by a woman who is a Pakistani American. Mm-hmm. And she was really excited because she went to see the movie The Big Sick. That's Kumail Nanjiani's film. And he is Pakistani American. And in the film, you know, she said, that is the first time I have seen my life experience portrayed in a Hollywood film.
And that's so recent.
Right. Yeah. It's very recent. And, you know, she's 30 years old. She's young, but, you know, the power for her of seeing herself in that film. And then just again with Black Panther, we started the hour with Black Panther. There are people who really, they've been waiting their whole lives to see themselves positively portrayed in film.
Yeah, absolutely.
Now, a lot of your research focuses on gender and sexuality. And we've been talking about ethnicity, but also, gender is something that I think we, again, have seen some growth in some really terrific roles for women. But that's been really problematic as well for a long time, hasn't it?
Yeah, just the representation of women on the whole.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, there's such a long sort of history of that. And, you know, there are all these different questions about how women have been represented. You know, in terms of, well, the happy housewives of the 1950s, you know, the Leave It to Beaver kind of, you know, perfect, whatever, homemakers, that kind of thing. The whole discourse of domesticity that was in women's magazines, you know, throughout the 50s, because women were coming back, you know, post-World War II, you know, there was a whole sort of national push to get women back into the home so that they could vacate the jobs that they had during the war so that men could go to work, you know, all this kind of stuff. You know, and then, of course, the turn toward, you know, the whole notion of the sexualization, objectification of women on screen, which is still something that people are sort of thinking and rather concerned about.
Well, and to take the leap from the sexualization and objectification of women on screen, let's take a further leap to talk about women of color on screen. Because again, I mean, as I've said, so often when people of color have been portrayed on screen, it has been to reinforce stereotypes.
Yep.
And I mean, let's talk about how Asian women have been portrayed historically on screen.
Yeah, and a lot of the sort of research about the way Asian women, particularly East Asian women, have been portrayed on screen, you know, sort of reverts to kind of two basic stereotypes, the dragon lady or the lotus blossom, right? So the dragon lady is gang affiliated, is sort of, you know, really vicious and tyrannical and evil and, you know, all those sorts of things. And the on the other hand, the lotus blossom is the, you know, subservient geisha girl, you know, that kind of stereotype, submissive and, you know, soft-spoken and, you know, that kind of thing. So with no sort of agency or power of her own. And, you know, those were the two representations. And, you know, and it's, those representations completely sort of overlooked and ignored, you know, real Asian women who are in a variety of different kinds of roles and, you know, doing all sorts of different things in society. But, yeah, it just sort of boiled down to those stereotypes.
Right.
The problem with those stereotypes, too, you know, if I could just tell a sort of quick story. I had a student who was a graduate student who was Korean-American, and she was a very, you know, very, very intelligent young woman and very sort of outspoken and very assertive, you know. So she was not a lotus blossom. And she was working for a professor who really, really expected her to be the sort of submissive, you know, docile kind of person that Asian women are supposed to be. And she really wasn't that. And it caused a lot of sort of friction and, you know, tension in her job, like, you know, because she wasn't embodying the stereotype, the expected stereotype. So,
well, and that's an anecdote,
yeah,
but there's research that totally backs that
yeah
up as well, that
yeah
we create these cultural expectations
yes
for individuals based on what we see in popular culture.
Right.
I mean, if you think about some of the studies that go back to the 1950s and 60s,
yes,
there was the study about children and looking at dolls.
Yep.
And they found that even black children preferred
yep
the white dolls.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, that's a very famous study that, as you say, was conducted in the 1950s. And African-American children were shown a white doll and a black doll and asked which was the good doll. They always said it was the white doll. Which was the bad doll? Always the black doll. Which doll represented them? And they would always point, you know, they'd point to the black doll and, you know, say, so I'm like the bad doll. And it was just really, really sad. And then that experiment was replicated quite recently after 2000. I don't remember which year exactly. And the findings were pretty much the same. So children do internalize these ideas and these stereotypes about, you know, them partly from the culture, but media is part of culture. And so, you know, we do need to look to see whether the media are sort of reinforcing the you know, the sort of traditional, stereotypical and often racist kinds of notions that have permeated the society for years and years.
Absolutely. We'd love to hear from you this hour. We're talking about representation in media. You can give us a call. I want to hear your story about the first time you really felt like you saw yourself reflected positively in media. And you can give us a call at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at Iowa Public Radio. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. With me, Gigi Durham, collegiate scholar and professor at the University of Iowa School of Journalism and Mass Communication. Noreen Nassim Rodriguez, assistant professor of elementary social studies at Iowa State University School of Education. And I want to read an email that we got. This is from Stephanie, who says, "For us, December of 2014 is seen as something of a holiday because it's when Nickelodeon aired the series finale of The Legend of Korra, a show that my wife and I were already ardent fans of. There had been hints that perhaps the lead character and another prominent female character had a romantic relationship. Much to our shock, the creators not only acknowledged and affirmed the nature of this relationship, but made it the final scene of the entire series. I will be forever grateful to the show creators for allowing us a same-sex relationship that didn't end in tragedy, was in fact quite healthy and involved the title character of a show that was of extremely high quality." That definitely speaks to the power of being able to see that on screen. Gigi?
Yeah, I mean, this really, the positive portrayals as well as negative portrayals do really resonate with audience members. As far as LGBTQ representation goes, there's a scholar named Larry Gross who's at the University of Southern California. And, you know, he's done a lot of work on media representations of those populations. And, you know, it's clear that for many, many years, LGBTQ people were portrayed as villains or sort of tragic figures that died early or something like that.
Or comic relief.
Yeah, our comic relief. Yeah, exactly. And one of the points he makes is that when people you know, don't have contact or connection with people of particular sort of especially marginalized groups in real life, then they take all their ideas from the media. And so, you know, if you're getting like consistently negative representations, then, you know, many people, especially if they're part of sort of mainstream groups, are going to perceive those communities to be, you know, only in terms of the stereotypes.
Well, and you were talking earlier mm-hmm. about searching for yourself in media and mm-hmm. finding yourself on the cover of a book of Heidi.
Yeah.
You know, I read an article recently that was an interview with the actress Molly Ringwald, mm-hmm. and she was reflecting on the movie 16 Candles. Mm-hmm. Not 16 Candles, pardon me, Pretty in Pink. Uh-huh. And there's a character in that movie who has this hopeless crush on her, Ducky, played by John Cryer. But apparently for a lot of gay young men, mm-hmm. Ducky became where they saw themselves.
Mm, interesting.
And so, you know, in searching for yourself in a character that, mm-hmm. that's just not in the media, sometimes people find themselves
yes.
in places where it wasn't necessarily intentional.
Right, in unexpected places, yeah.
Absolutely. Uh-huh. Well, mm-hmm. and Narina, I wanted to ask you, I mean, Gigi was just mentioning how so often LGBT characters can be villains or comic relief, that kind of stereotype. Of course, that's something we also see with Muslim characters in movies, on television, where historically speaking, Muslim characters have been relegated mostly to the roles of villains. I mean, that has a pretty powerful effect, doesn't it?
Absolutely. And that's kind of a broader narrative post 9/11 that we've seen in the media. There are some instances where they do provide comic relief, often in the form of a convenience store worker or a taxi driver. We've seen more instances of them as doctors, and it's gotten a little bit better. But I think historically, and we continue to see this. I mean, I think 24 and Homeland were two of the biggest examples because they were so incredibly popular after 9/11. And they, you know, 24 ran for many, many seasons, and Homeland continues to run into, I don't know, it's been over 7 seasons, I believe. So people are still watching this stuff. But I think, moreover, we in particular see a lot of images of Muslim women as oppressed. And that is certainly a trope that I think is very prominent today as well.
Which, again, I mean, as Gigi and I were just talking about, that has cultural implications. It's not just for Muslim girls and Muslim women seeing those characters and feeling that maybe it reflects them, but it's for non-Muslim mm-hmm. girls and non-Muslim women and the rest of the culture that sees that and thinks that's the truth.
Exactly. I think there was a Pew survey that came out a few years ago that said that a third of Americans have never even met a Muslim. And so if you've never met a person of this particular faith, then what you see in the media is all the understanding that you may have if you don't have the time or interest in pursuing more information on your own. And so, yeah, we definitely see Muslim men pretty much in the image of Osama bin Laden. So bearded with these turbans, which are often not something that Muslim men wear, but Sikh men do wear them often. And so that's part of why we've seen a lot of violence and discrimination against members of the Sikh community. Mm-hmm. So completely different set of beliefs. Yet because of the ways in which Muslims have been portrayed in the media, people misunderstand them to be Muslims and often are, you know, aggressive, hateful. We know that both Sikh Muslim children, other children that are perceived to be Muslim, have been bullied in school because of what other kids think is bad. And so they see a child that matches this visual image of what a bad person looks like from movies, from TV, from video games. And so they attack these other kids who have done nothing terroristic, obviously. These are 5, 6, 7, 8-year-olds on a bus doing nothing. But because of what these kids are seeing in the media around them, we're seeing a lot of these behaviors persist. And we're many, many years past 9/11, you know? So it's of deep concern.
And I'm sure a lot of people think, but this is fiction. These are movies. These are TV shows. This is a fictional account. Why does it have such an impact? And I'd love both of you to speak to that, because we're not talking about news coverage or reflection in the news media, which is a whole different conversation. But why are these fictional accounts so powerful? Gigi?
Can I jump in? This is a quote that I really love from Doug Kellner, who's a media scholar at UCLA, and he says, Radio, television, film, and the other products of media culture provide materials out of which we forge our very identities, our sense of selfhood, our notion of what it means to be male or female, our sense of class, of ethnicity and race, of nationality, of sexuality, of us and them. Media images help shape our view of the world and our deepest values, what we consider good or bad, positive or negative, moral or evil. Media stories provide the symbols, myths, and resources through which we constitute a common culture and through the appropriation of which we insert ourselves into this culture. We are immersed from cradle to grave in a media and consumer society. I just love that quote. And I think it's, you know, I think it's so true and telling. We are surrounded by, we are in a media-saturated environment. We are surrounded by these images. These are our stories. These are our touchstones. These are our references. How can we imagine that they don't have an effect?
Well, and it's interesting because we often shield our children from news.
Right.
But of course we don't shield children from these fictional worlds.
No. No, and that they have, you know, they're equally influential. If they weren't influential, there would be no media industry, right? I mean, they wouldn't even be out there. So.
Well, and Noreen, I want to hear your thoughts on that as well, but we're going to have to wait until after a break. We're going to take a short break. We'll be right back. This hour, we're talking about representation in media, why it matters to see people of color and other people in underrepresented groups portrayed positively in movies, on television, in books. We want to hear from you, your stories about maybe the first time you saw yourself reflected positively in pop culture. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. With me, Meenakshi Gigi Durham, collegiate scholar and professor at the University of Iowa School of Journalism and Mass Communication, and Noreen Nassim Rodriguez, assistant professor of elementary social studies at Iowa State University's School of Education. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about representation in media. I think we all know that far too often in Hollywood movies, on U.S. television, and even in books, people of color or other underrepresented groups are relegated to the roles of sidekick or stereotype or villain. And seeing yourself, whatever identity you have, positively portrayed in popular culture can be a very powerful experience. We'd love to hear your story of the first time you really saw yourself reflected in popular media. You can give us a call at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. With me this hour, Noreen Nassim Rodriguez, assistant professor of elementary social studies at Iowa State University School of Education, Meenakshi Gigi Durham, collegiate scholar and professor at the University of Iowa School of Journalism and Mass Communication. And Noreen, I want to hear your thoughts in just a moment. But first, I do want to read an email. This is from Sean. He said, as a closeted teen in the 90s, I dreaded sitcoms where either someone being gay was a punchline or else a straight character dreaded people thinking that they're gay. And I've just been rewatching the sitcom Friends with my kids. That's an ongoing storyline and punchline that comes up again and again. And Noreen, just before the break, we were talking about why this matters. You know, it's just fiction. They're just stories. Why is this so powerful? What are your thoughts?
So I think stories are how we understand each other. It's how we express our humanity and our identities. And we know that media is powerful, but I think in the absence of these other stories in the curriculum when kids are in school for 40 hours a week, it makes media even more of an impact because, you know, the vast majority of children's literature is either about animals or white characters. And so we don't see a lot of representation of children of color, of LGBT youth, of differently abled students, of students that are not Christian. And so when you don't get any information about these other people that you may not know personally in real life, then whatever you see on TV and in the movies, that's what you understand those stories to be. And so I think especially given the absence of these alternative stories, these more factual representations, these more nuanced descriptions of different kinds of experiences. So what does it mean to be a gay white boy versus a gay black boy if you are both living in Grinnell, Iowa, right? Like, how might those experiences be different and nuanced and have similar tensions? But if we don't ever get experiences to have those conversations in a school setting that's guided, where you can talk to your peers, then what you see on TV, on Friends, or on Will and Grace, that's all the information you're getting.
Well, and thinking about books in particular, although all of this media, I mean, consuming a fictional story can be an incredibly powerful emotional experience, but it's also sort of a way that we practice things, that we experience these emotions and prepare ourselves for life. So if you don't see yourself reflected, do you feel like that's a part of the experience, even as, say, a reader that you're not getting?
Absolutely. There's a literacy scholar named Rudine Sims Bishop that talks about the importance of books as both mirrors and windows. So you want to have windows into other worlds and experiences that are different from your own, but you also want to be able to see yourself reflected to affirm who you are and to affirm that you're okay, that children can look different ways and be different ways and still be important and be worth reading about. And when you don't ever see someone that looks like you in books, it almost feels like your story doesn't matter, like you're invisible.
I want to take a phone call here. Here's David in Grimes. Hi, David.
Hi.
Hi, what would you like to talk about?
Well, I don't have a whole lot to complain about as a white male in terms of representation, but as a self-professed nerd, the rise of a show like The Big Bang Theory was really refreshing to me to see, a smart male rather than this macho man on TV and see the rise of that. And people enjoy that and love that. Even though it is a bit of a caricature, it was still really nice and refreshing to see.
Right, and it's a caricature, but as a viewer, you kind of feel like you're in on the joke, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Well, yeah, David, that's a great point. I mean, obviously, identities come in all different shapes, sizes, colors, etc. I mean, Gigi, what do you think about what Dave's saying powerful that is?
I think he made a really excellent point, actually, because there are egregious stereotypes of masculinity out there too. And there's a scholar named R.W. Connell who talks about hegemonic masculinity, which is what we see in the media all the time, which is like the Rock, right? I mean, this muscly, brawny, aggressive, assertive, violent character, and that is supposed to embody sort of ideal masculinity, and that's what we get over and over in the Schwarzenegger characters and all these whatever superhero movies and things like that. And the point that Connell makes is that there's a whole range of masculinities, right? That there are all kinds of It's not unmasculine to be, as Dave was saying, a nerd, or it's not unmasculine to be a poet or a teacher or a pediatrician or a caring, sort of nurturing person. That's masculine, too. But all of those kinds of masculinities are lumped under alternative masculinities that are somehow not as good as the stereotypical aggressive masculinity. So I think it really matters to have a whole range of representations of masculinity. And to me, those, if you want to, quote-unquote alternative masculinities, are very sort of positive expressions of masculinity. I mean, we're seeing so much right now in terms of the aggressive, especially aggressive sexuality, right, with, so many stories of sexual misconduct and abuse and so on. So I think, to me, it's tremendously important to actually portray other forms of masculinity that are more caring, that are more,
Yeah. Absolutely. Well, and David, are you still there?
Yeah.
I want to go back in time because, of course, when I was growing up, the Revenge of the Nerds movies were huge. They were terrible. Terrible. But the movie, as a hardcore nerd myself, one of the movies that I just loved and really saw myself in was Real Genius. Was that one that you watched, Dave?
Yeah, I saw that too. And I remember the Nerds very well. I love those.
Absolutely. Well, thanks a lot for your call. Real Genius was about super smart kids at a university, that very elite university who ended up doing some pretty remarkable things. But the nerds were pretty cool in that one, and that really worked for me.
Yeah. More recently, Hidden Figures about the African-American women at NASA. I mean, that, smart's great. And that was a whole sort of different portrayal of African-American
absolutely.
Women.
Absolutely. Absolutely. That very, very powerful film. Here's an email from Chase. He is he would like both of you to respond to an idea written about in a Vice News editorial. And I have a quote from the editorial here in just a moment. But this is about the game Far Cry 5, in which the author stated that there were, quote, too many black people for the region in American or Montana that the game is set in. For many of us who follow this topic, it seems like this is counterintuitive to the discussion of representation. And for those of us in the video game space, this feels like consistent nitpicking for the the sake of nitpicking, I want to read you the quote from the editorial as well. It says, "It's not that I dislike black people. Full disclosure, I am black. It's just that for a series that prides itself on realism, my experience of constantly bumping into assault rifle-toting black people in the forests of Montana just seems unrealistic." So obviously this is probably not an argument or a game that either one of you has a lot of familiarity with, but do you think there are people who do feel like it's constant nitpicking? Gigi, do you want to respond to that?
Well, yeah, I'm not familiar with that game. So, I mean, I can't sort of give an informed opinion in terms of I've never seen it. I don't know if the quote unquote assault weapon toting black people are you know, villains or good guys, or I don't know. But the question of sort of numbers in terms of representation is really an interesting one. I mean, the critique of Friends, for example, is that they inhabit an all-white New York City, which is one of the most diverse cities in the world, right? But the group of people on Friends, I mean, they're like almost never any representations of anyone other than sort of straight white people, unless they're kind of background figures or occasional sort of cameo appearances. So, I mean, this is always something that people have sort of, you know, troubled and questioned, like, what is reality? But, you know, in terms of, it's hard for me to say whether, you know, the representation in this video game is, you know, something to critique or not. I mean, of course, you know, when I'm sure, I don't know what the actual demographic breakdown is in Montana. I'm guessing it's predominantly white, so it probably is an unrealistic representation, but how it plays out in the game is something I'd like to know more about.
Right. Well, we'll look into that after the hour. Noreen, did you have anything you wanted to add to that?
I mean, I would just be curious as to, are these black men with assault rifles portrayed in a stereotypically violent fashion? If so, then perhaps that particular issue of representation is damaging and you know, racist, problematic. But I think there have been some examples. I think Kumail Nanjiani, actually, since we mentioned him earlier, mentioned that there was a video game that was supposed to be set in Lahore, Pakistan. And instead of having Urdu written all around them, all the text was in Arabic, which is not a language that is spoken in Pakistan. Muslims might use it for religious purposes, but that's not one of the major languages of Pakistan. And it's just like an inattention to detail is something that we often see. But I think this idea of, you know, okay, so if we think about the American population, what percentage is Asian American? That's how many Asian characters proportionally we should have in this video game. I think I can understand why people have issues with the nitpicking, but I think it comes from the fact that so many of us have been invisible for so long, and we've seen such a great response to people like Shonda Rhimes, who just have these diverse casts. And it isn't just diversity in terms of race, it's diversity in terms of all kinds of things. And so to be able to have characters who are LGBT, to be able to have characters who are not Christian, to be able to have characters who maybe aren't cisgender, there's all these different dynamics, who are nerds, to have these different dynamics. And it doesn't necessarily need to be front and center, but I don't think it's nitpicky to just ask for more diversity. I do think in this video game it seems a little odd, but again, not knowing that much, I can't speak specifically to that.
Right. Well, and for those of us who have not been invisible, I think it's really difficult to understand what that must feel like. I'm speaking for myself. But given that the majority population in the United States is Caucasian, we don't know what that feels like for the most part. I want to read this email. This is from Kate. She says, "As a white person and professional illustrator, I recognized long ago that part of my job was to insert people of color as much as possible into my illustrations. Illustrations in everything from books to corporate ads seem to only feature pasty white folk like me, totally missing the beauty of diversity." But I mean, to go back to your story about seeing the cover of Heidi, a picture can be so powerful, right, Gigi?
Incredibly. And yay, Kate. You know, that's so great that she's thinking about these things, you know, because it does matter. Really, people are deeply affected by the images and the visuals that they see around them. Yeah
and Noreen, and looking at children's books, I mean, again, with illustrations, that gives you just a lot of power. Even if the text isn't specifically written to recognize your identity, but if you can see yourself in pictures, right?
Absolutely. Different hair textures. I have a really good friend who has extraordinarily curly hair, and I know she hasn't seen enough images of little girls with auburn super curly hair in her life. And that would have been something that would have been very affirming to her in a land where most people have straight hair. Seeing illustrations where the characters have different skin tones, where they have freckles, you know, just representing what people look like rather than just one particular version of what it means to be a little girl or a little boy.
Here's another email. This is from Linda. She says, commercials can be examples that provide normalization to families who are built in ways other than biological means. As a parent of a foreign-born adopted child, I'm heartened to see commercials that occasionally feature families different from the ones most of us grew up with. I've seen commercials featuring Caucasian parents giving medicine and comfort to their Asian children, a white-black couple with a mixed-race child where the Caucasian dad picks up his biracial daughter from school, a blended family buying insurance to provide protection for both sets of children, caring families doing caring things that we can all identify with are valuable. Mm-hmm. We've also seen controversy in response to commercials that show different kinds of families. But I mean, that's not something that we necessarily seek out to look at. But Gigi, in these sort of 30-second fictional stories mm-hmm. that get presented to us as commercials, that really is powerful as well.
Yeah, tremendously. I mean, the ad industry is a multi-billion dollar industry. You know, again, it has tremendous impact. Everyone in media studies, we call it, there's a third person effect where everyone says, oh, well, everyone else is affected by media, but I'm not personally, right? And yet, you know, the ad industry wouldn't be sort of raking in billions of dollars if it weren't effective, right? So these representations really do have an impact, not only in terms of selling products, but in conveying, sort of cultural norms and ideas and ideologies and so on. So, yes, those 30-second spots matter. And there was a time when the kinds of diverse representations, that were referred to were just, they weren't there at all. I mean, honestly, there was nothing except stereotypical nuclear family, a mom and a dad and two kids or whatever. And now gradually you are seeing, more diversity of representation. Ad agencies seem to be picking up on the fact that, the families in today's America and today's world are not all alike.
We're almost out of time, but I don't have time to take another call. Jeff in Des Moines says that he feels like we're all too sensitive about everything. We're targeted by marketers who want to break us down to core common denominators so they can sell to us on the basis of identity. It's our free enterprise system. Now, that's an interesting argument, although for a long time, Noreen, in media, we've seen the free enterprise system deciding before giving it a try that things that feature minorities aren't going to sell. I mean, we just saw Black Panther be hugely, yes. hugely profitable. But how long did it take to get there?
Well, I think part of the problem is we want diversity on screen, but we also want diversity behind the camera and in the writer's room, too. And when you have people that aren't mindful of those things that are funding what gets produced and what gets written, then that's part of the problem. I mean, I am super excited about Crazy Rich Asians because that is the first major motion picture in the last 25 years with a full Asian and Asian American cast. But how long does it take? It's taken 25 years for that to happen again. I think in terms of free enterprise, people want this. That's why more of this stuff is getting funded. But I think a lot of people are also afraid of it. If you think about Ghost in the Shell, where they had Scarlett Johansson play an Asian character, that movie tanked. And I think there's reasons for that. And studios are starting to wise up because this is a growing population. There's a market for it. And it'll do you well to try to serve some of these populations more strategically.
Well, thank you so much for being here today and being so generous with your personal story as well. Noreen Nassim Rodriguez.
Thank you for having me.
Noreen Nassim Rodriguez, Assistant Professor of Elementary Social Studies at Iowa State University School of Education. And Gigi, thank you again for being so generous with your personal story as well as your expertise.
It's been great. Thank you, Charity.
Meenakshi Gigi Durham, Collegiate Scholar and Professor at the University of Iowa School of Journalism and Mass Communication. We've been talking about the importance of representation in media this hour. Talk of Iowa is produced by Iowa Public Radio. Our producers are Emily Woodbury, Dennis Reese, Ben Stanton, and Lindsay Moon. We had production assistance today from Natalia Reyes, and we had technical support as well in Ames. Thank you so much for your help today. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.